very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. We've got some happy Tuesday music on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks very much, everyone, for tuning in. It's Tuesday. That means we'll check on Wall Street with the great John Najeri. And Andrew Herman will be here a little bit later. He's going to, you know, openings and closings he talks about from DNA Info Chicago. And he's going to introduce us to a barber on the north side. I think the guy's 97, 98 years old. He actually cut hair in the camps in World War II, and he is finally retiring, so a bit of a salute to him. But we'll start with John Najarian from CNBC and at John Najarian and just about everywhere else. John, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Great to be with you, Stephen. Thank you.
Okay, now I'm going to explain this to you, and you tell me if I've got it right. The EU is demanding that Apple pay back $14.5 billion in taxes to Ireland, taxes that Ireland says it doesn't want. Did I get that right?
You did get that right, sir. Yes. Basically, it's Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, wrote a scathing letter back to, it's an open letter that they published, Apple did, basically saying, hey, we fully complied. In fact, the United States says we don't owe any tax over there. Ireland says we don't owe any tax beyond what they've paid. And the issue is, I guess, Stephen, that the European Union is saying everything from VAT or value-added taxes that should have been picked up within the European Union were not. And the fact that they're located in Ireland with this, I think the maximum tax rate there is 12%, 12 or 13%, is significantly lower than the rest of Europe, which is one of the reasons that's attractive to companies like Apple and Facebook. But they want them to collect that $13 billion plus another $1.5 billion or so in fines and penalties. And Apple will fight this. It'll take years. But I don't think this is a reason to not own Apple shares. It's already come better than $2 off the low that it hit in the pre-market.
Well, it's got enough cash around, right? I mean, the $14.5 billion isn't going to hurt it very much. If it has to pay.
Right. And my issue wouldn't be so much that $14 billion isn't a big number, even though for a company Apple's size with that much cash, $200 billion plus in free cash, it is a relatively small piece, let's say 7% of their free cash. But nonetheless, they're going to fight this all the way. In all likelihood, they will either get it, A, dismissed, or B, they will pay a lesser number. And it'll be 3 to 5 years from now.
Right.
So between zero and some portion less than the $14 billion over those 3 to 5 years, I don't think that's the reason to be out of the stock right here.
And Ireland doesn't want the Apple to have to pay because that would make them less attractive to other businesses that they're luring over from the States. Is that correct?
Very true. And long before they had an iPhone or an iPod, Stephen Jobs set up a tech center in Cork, Ireland. And he's continued to grow that. And then when he passed, his successor, Mr. Cook, has continued to grow it. They've got over 6,000 employees over there. And they say that this would severely inhibit not only their growth, but other companies, just to your point, Stephen. So I think in all likelihood, this is an overreach by a tax authority, and it's unlikely to result in Apple paying a significant amount of that.
I am going to lead a group of WGN listeners to Ireland about 6 weeks from now, and we're going to be in Cork, so maybe I'll drop in on the facility and see.
A lovely place. You got to hit,
Kenmare or Kinsale?
Yeah, Kinsale,
yeah.
Exactly. That's one of my favorite places.
Well, we'll be there, so I'm looking forward to that. Okay, so what did we get from the government today? There was a confidence report, right, that indicated it was a nice report. Things could be picking up.
Yeah, it's the same sort of thing the Fed has been telling us that has been happening, that indeed the U.S. consumer is doing a little better, and they're feeling a little more, if not bullish. Certainly the fact that they drew down into their savings these past couple months for this last quarter that we just closed the book on, even though the GDP as a whole was not great, consumers were spending at a pretty good clip. So they were feeling good. And it's probably because they were working down inventories, businesses were. And the fact that they were working those inventories down meant that things were on sale. And I don't know about you, Stephen. I suspect you and I both are big fans of sales.
If I have to choose between full price and sale, John, I almost always choose sale.
Sure, why wouldn't you?
Even if it doesn't fit, it's on sale. Okay, also, this is the last time we will talk in August, obviously. It's the 30th of August, and I'm reading that September historically is the worst month for U.S. stocks. That, you know, if you look at it since the Dow Jones was formed, that September is the month that performs the worst. Any idea why that might be?
I don't have a specific reason why that would be. I really don't. But I do think we might have a little bit of a choppy start to the beginning of the month of September, and then I think it'll smooth out and be fine by the end. I think that because we're at record highs for our markets virtually across the board, and we're sort of in a no man's land for a couple weeks as far as significant earnings, and then we start up with another earnings cycle. So I think people may be willing to take some money off the table ahead of those big reports. And for that reason, that could be a little choppy.
Is there a point where things sort of just get put on hold ahead of a presidential election?
Well, you know, there could be. I guess it really depends. The candidates right now are similar in a lot of their what they're mouthing anyway. Both Trump and then Hillary Clinton followed on with them about that Trans-Pacific tax pact,
right.
It's the trade pact, and it seems like that's not going to be moving forward. That was one of the major things that could have been a negative. Ms. Clinton, of course, is very negative about biotechs, and I'm negative about anybody who's overcharging like Mylan with those EpiPens. And I think those stocks would be the ones that you'd want to avoid, at least in the short term, are many of those stocks in that space.
Well,
outside of the Zika treatments.
I want to talk to you about the Mylan story, too, because I think it was 20 senators, Senator Durbin among them, sent a letter to Mylan today saying what you're offering to do and to cut the generic form and all of that isn't enough. Mylan, of course, grossly exaggerated the cost of their EpiPens. I just figure that this is happening right and left. I mean, if we just started looking at companies, we would find companies that bill the government for health care doing this left and right.
Yep, but the key there is, and you're 100% right, Stephen, the key is you have to look for it. You don't have to look very hard, but
no,
you have to look for it.
Just get sick.
And unfortunately, the regulators didn't look. The FTC didn't look. Federal Trade Commission. The FDA that regulates drugs didn't look. Our senators, Mr. Durbin and the rest of them, didn't look. And yet regular Americans were getting hit with these bills all the time. They looked. And that's how it ultimately got reported. It wasn't that the Senate saw this or Hillary or Trump or anybody else. It was regular Joes and Janes that went to get the EpiPen to restock for the school year and all of a sudden said, are you kidding me? They're $600 now?
Yeah,
I just pay $100 last year?
The whole thing is ripe for some good reporting, too. I think that's where it'll come out. John Najarian, good to talk to you again today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
Have a great Labor Day weekend.
You too, sir.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. 1223, it is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. You know, Jillian Berman writes for MarketWatch.com. She's on the show from time to time. She's going to be with us in the next half hour, and she says the greatest fiscal gift her parents gave her was not having a brother or sister. It's an essay about how far ahead she is because she's an only child. Our Andrew Herman is here from DNA Info. I think you're not an only child.
I'm not an only child, and I'm thinking end of life issues when your parents are ill and it's all on you.
You know, that's a big part of the article. We're going to talk to her about that.
Oh,
it is, yeah,
that's
because she talks about that's the biggest disadvantage that you don't have siblings to fight with over on what to do.
Yeah.
Okay, we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about getting our hair cut on the north side. Tell me about this barber, 96-year-old Holocaust survivor up in Westridge, who's leaving work, the slacker.
Yeah, right. He's retiring at age 96. He's been operating, as you say, for 60 years. Ben Scheinkopf's barbershop at 7204 North California. And he recently put a sign in the window and said he physically can't do it anymore at 96. But he's had a great career, and he has a fascinating backstory. He was a Holocaust survivor. He was in Auschwitz. He's cut generations of hair in the neighborhood, and he just wrote a very nice letter in which he thanks the neighborhood and kind of lays out his plans for what he's going to do next.
I think he referred to himself as a youthful person of almost 97 years of age.
Yeah, yeah. So his background, like I say, he was born in Poland, a Jewish fellow who was put into the ghettos and eventually into the concentration camps, and cut hair of the people there, and got out and started cutting American soldiers' hair, and eventually found his way to Chicago, where he made a great life for himself.
Benny the Barber. God bless you, Benny. So
yeah.
Work till 96. That's becoming I don't know if 96 is more typical,
yeah. But the retirement age is going up now. It's 64 for men, according to the government, and that's been going up, ticking up in recent years. But 7% of people 80 or older are still in the workforce.
70%?
7%.
7%.
Okay.
Right. Wow, people
yeah.
80 and older.
Yeah, so a lot of people have a lot of stamina, I guess, more than I would have.
I wonder if it's stamina or need. I bet it's stamina by then.
It could be need, too. I mean, you know, the reason that the retirement age is going up, there's many reasons, but one of them is lack of money, this sort of disintegration of the pension plan system in which you had a defined pension.
Right.
Has been wiped out over the years for various reasons, and people just have to keep working.
I was talking to the Inno Boys yesterday about this other story, the Amazon brick-and-mortar store.
Mm-hmm.
It's going up in the Southport corridor. You know, and we were laughing a little bit about how they... You know, video killed the radio star, Amazon killed the bookstore, and now they're opening one. But tell me about the reception in the neighborhood for that.
Yeah, so this is the Amazon bookstore, 3443 North Southport in Lakeview. It's opening in 2017. And as you know, they are dominant in the book-selling business. They have 60% of all book sales. Apparently, they want some more, and so they're going to have a bricks-and-mortar store. Some of the locals aren't all that thrilled with them coming into the neighborhood.
Well, they don't want the chains, is that it? They don't want the big businesses?
Well, there's four independent bookstores. Stores within 2 miles of there.
Okay.
So that's your first problem there in terms of competition. But other businesses are also worried because they say that these chains are moving into this area known as the Southport corridor, like J. Crew and Gap and Lululemon and all kinds of different stores that are chain stores. And our reporter, Ariel Chung, looked at rents and found that they've actually gone up 50% since 2003. And so it's about $41 a square foot now. And the locals blame the chains for driving up the cost of rent and pricing them out of the area.
So the local businesses, you know, foster the growth in the area, make it attractive, and then the chains come in and sort of ghettoize it.
Yeah, I think they can coexist, though.
Do you?
I think you can't have just chains, or otherwise it won't be as attractive. But, you know, chains exist for a reason. People like them.
Right.
Right? They like the stuff they sell, and they like the
prices. Jared and I were talking. We like to buy things on sale.
Right.
Yeah.
The Amazon thing, I'm not quite clear on. I mean, I buy stuff on Amazon.com, but it's usually kind of boring stuff. Stuff that I don't really need right away.
Right,
like
right.
I bought, like, a glass tabletop the other day because somebody used it as an ironing board. But, you know, in terms of when I want to go out and buy stuff for that sort of immediate gratification, it's bricks and mortars. I don't really, you know, just buy stuff online sort of like an impulse buy.
Right. Well, that's because you're not your kid's age.
Maybe you're right. Maybe it is an age thing. But,
read more about Benny the Barber and Amazon as well at DNAinfo.com. Andrew Herman, thanks for coming by.
All right, Steve.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, Jillian Berman is on a phone line. She writes for MarketWatch.com and joins us from time to time. Jillian, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome, and I want to give my best to your brothers and sisters. Wait a minute, you don't have any brothers and sisters.
Nope, no, I don't.
So I put this on my Twitter page and on Facebook, too. I want you to read it. Jillian writes a piece today. The headline is, "My parents made the smartest financial decision of my life, and that decision was not to have any other kids."
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, that's not necessarily why they didn't, but it turned out well for me, at least financially.
And so tell me about have there been studies of this to look if only, I mean, it seems logical, but is there much evidence that proves the point that only kids do better financially?
There's not a ton of research on it, mostly because a lot of the studies on only children have to do with their sociability, or other things that people might be more curious about. But, you know, like you said, it's logical. Parents just have, if they have only one kid, they have more resources to devote to it.
Right. So, I mean, I know you by our phone conversations. We probably had a half a dozen or so. And you don't seem to be an incredibly self-centered person.
Thank you. I'm glad that you feel that way.
Well, I thought that's what only children were.
Yeah, right. Well, so, I mean, I like to hope that they're not. But I think, you know, one thing that is clear is they do get some advantages that maybe other that children with siblings don't. And they maybe get them without, you know, necessarily demanding them in the way that, you know, the stereotype says. But that doesn't mean that, you know, they still don't have a leg up sometimes.
Well, but we do sort of as a society look at only kids or parents with only one child differently than we do of parents with of a couple of kids or three or even four.
Yeah, that's definitely true. There's, you know, families are getting smaller in the U.S., but there's still certainly a stigma about it. And, you know, and I think there is kind of this idea out there that having only one kid, you know, is maybe selfish, or, you know, that the kid itself doesn't grow up learning how to share, or, you know, or doesn't learn sort of important lessons that come with siblings.
You know, you said something there that the families are getting smaller. In the piece you write, in 2014, 18% of American women ages 40 to 44 had only one child. Signs that's changing. In 1976, 10% of women had only one child. So the number is going up. Does that have to do with economics?
It may. It's kind of hard to say. We do know that during tough economic times, you know, we often see families shrink. So, for example, in the Great Depression, only children became more common than they were before. So it might have to do with the economy. It might also just have to do with sort of changing preferences, people having children older now and, you know, and both parents working and all of that.
Okay, so did you have really wild birthday parties when you were a kid?
That's a great question. I don't think my birthday parties were any more wild than those of my friends with siblings. I did actually, come to think of it, I had a great Sweet 16 party. That was that was great.
So. I'm sorry I didn't know you then. I would have come.
Yeah, right.
But it is true. I mean, you look at statistics that parents, and it's, again, it's sort of an obvious thing, but parents of only one child spend more money on that one child than parents of two children spend per child on their two.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously it makes sense financially, but, you know, there's sort of some psychological stuff going on there, too, that the one kid is, you know, is their one shot, right? So they're going to put a lot of investment in that one child to make sure he or she turns out well.
Well, I've got two, and I haven't written off either one. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, right. I mean, it's good to hear that you haven't.
No. What do you think is the best or the biggest advantage of financially? Of being an only child? Is it the college costs or is it something else?
I think, yeah, that's a pretty huge one. Most of the other only children I spoke to, that was one that they pointed to, right, is college is so expensive. And, you know, whatever help you can get paying for it, whether that means only paying for one kid, you know, that can really help. And to graduate with no debt or with less debt, you know, is a huge advantage.
It is.
But
the other thing, and I brought this your piece up earlier with an earlier guest on the show, and he instantly said, I don't know about the benefit, because when the parents get older, there's only one of you to look after them. And that's something you write about as well.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's a huge concern. A lot of the only children I spoke to expressed that, you know, they're going to be the only one responsible for their parents' care. And one woman I spoke to said she even kind of considers it the, you know, the payback for the financial advantages she got earlier on. But, you know, of course, siblings fight. And, you right. know, and not everything is easy when it comes to caring for aging parents, even amongst siblings. So, you know, it's hard to say what's more difficult.
I think this is one of those areas, and you know, where everyone wants to argue that they took the right path, that they made the right decision. So I'm sure there are people out there, you know, with five kids listening, saying, you know, my kids have so much more than financial benefit than someone, you know what I mean, by having kids that they grew up with. Whereas you're looking at the financial and the attention of your parents, it's kind of a it's a no answer argument, and it's one that we all want to win. So I appreciated the story you wrote. Hey, look, we've got a minute left. You
yeah.
also wrote, I think it was today or just recently, about Washington College and their effort
yeah.
to get people to save more for college. Tell me about that a little bit.
Yeah, so Washington College is a small liberal arts college in Eastern Maryland, and a new program that they announced this week is that they will match savings to a 529 plan. So basically, if parents save for college and use some of that savings to pay for their kids' tuition at Washington College, Washington will give those kids a little bit of a scholarship that's kind of tied to how much their parents have saved.
So the idea is you set aside $2,500, Washington will knock $2,500 off the bill.
Exactly.
It's not a fix, but it's a step toward making things more affordable. I know that. I remember when President Obama talked about getting rid of the 529 plan, a political nightmare for him that he backed away from pretty quickly.
Yeah, so the 529 plans and this program in general are a little bit controversial because they're considered to be more of a boon to wealthier families. The tax advantages that come with the plans, you know, go up
sure.
the higher the tax bracket you go. So, you know, this program will probably benefit, you know, middle income or even upper middle income families more than lower income families.
But it's an effort to find a solution, and we need solutions. So good for them.
Yes, exactly.
Do you ever see the movie Groundhog Day?
Yes.
Much of it was shot in Woodstock, Illinois, which is in the northwest suburbs here. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to some of the leaders from Woodstock about how they use that movie and other things to brand their town. So thanks for joining us today, Jillian.
Thank you for having me.
We'll go to Woodstock coming up on the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you, Steve Alexander. It is 12:51 here on the Business Lunch, 720 WGN. I'm not sure that song was written about Woodstock, Illinois.
I don't think it was.
Look who's here, a city councilman from Woodstock, Mike Turner. Welcome to the Business Lunch.
Terrific to be here. Thank you very
so
much.
So we're talking about the idea, and I'm interested in this. You know, Mayor Emanuel, one thing he's really done in coming into office is sort of raid the suburbs of businesses that had established out there, you know, and brought them back. I live in Deerfield, where the Bulls used to be, mm-hmm. where a number of businesses used to be, and he's, you know, bringing them into the city. As a suburb, I would imagine it's a marketing and always a struggle to bring people into your town as well. Is that something you're dealing with?
Well, what the creation of Real Woodstock was designed to both bring awareness of Woodstock as a terrific community for its residents, for the folks in the area, but then also to draw people from outside of the area for both tourism, retail, nightlife, and entertainment, for business.
Yeah, so do you want them to move in or just come visit and spend their money?
We'll take both.
Yeah?
We're open for business for tourism, but also we'd love to have folks consider us to live.
Now, people think of the movie Groundhog Day, mm-hmm. But they've been thinking of that for a long time.
Right? They have.
So that's got to be you got to overcome that challenge too.
Yeah, we find a way to highlight what Groundhog Day was to us as a city, but we're way more than that. And Real Woodstock is about promoting the entire area and the things that we do beyond even Groundhog Day.
Tell me a little bit about the process. How do you come up with a plan to do that?
Well, what we did is we saw a need to highlight the area, and it's something that we wanted to create a public-private partnership on. And so we created something very unique, city-funded, but a private entity, nonprofit, with two council members as well as three private citizens that drive the promotion, creation and the efforts of Promote Woodstock.
How long has it been up and running?
We're in our second year right now, second fiscal year, and it's been phenomenally successful.
What's the cost?
It costs us first year about $100,000 a year. Second year, we up that to $200,000. That is City of Woodstock money, and right. We're very cognizant of that we take care of that. But we're also looking to expand that to the private sector to get co-ops and businesses that want to participate as well. And we have folks committed to doing that.
Have you been successful?
We have. We've got businesses that have shown both an interest and also have actually committed, and we've gotten people to rally around it. We've gotten the Chamber of Commerce. We've gotten the merchants on the square. We've gotten the community aware of what we're doing.
How do you measure success of the program in general? Do you do that by tax revenue, or how do you figure if the money's well spent?
You know, that's a great question, and we have to do it based upon both subjective and objective measures. We're looking for those objective ones, subjective ones. What are our likes on our Facebook page? What kind of web traffic do we have? How do our merchants see their traffic going within the City of Woodstock? Those are things combined with long-term, you know, tax revenue would definitely be one of the things that we look at from a sales perspective.
And I'm always about the subjective stuff because I think it's so important for people who live in a town to believe in the town they live in, right? To not jump borders to go somewhere else, to stay home and enjoy what they've got. So, I mean, I can see where your audience is the other, but it's the people at home as well.
We want people in town to feel proud of who we are, and Real Woodstock, I think, as a website and as a Facebook page, does that. We want to communicate with local people and people beyond our borders.
Okay, so year two now, year three coming. If you're going to spend more money, what are you going to do with the extra money?
Well, it's not extra. We fund ourselves on an ongoing basis so that we can do things like print and Metro advertising. We can do Facebook advertising. We do radio. And so all of those efforts go into building the brand, creating awareness, and keeping it constant.
Have you looked at what other towns are doing? I mean, do you compare yourself to other programs?
We do. And we're fortunate to have a partner that's actually a Chicago-based business, A5. A5 is a marketing, a digital branding and marketing company based down here in the Loop that we partner with. And there are folks that help drive this.
One of the things that's interesting to me, I've read recently, you know, that towns have a new challenge in when it comes to revenue because, you know, as we're buying more and more things, we were talking earlier about Amazon and people are spending more money online. The bricks and mortar stores, the places that towns used to depend on for property taxes and all that is shrinking a little bit. Is that the case in Woodstock? And if it is, how do you discourage that, or what do you do to replace it?
I think the uniqueness of our square allows us to bypass some of that, and I would say even the merchants down there recognize that they can sell and take advantage of things online. But we're certainly cognizant of the need to continue to build our brand, to create an experience so that when people come and visit us, that they're met with an experience that they can enjoy as both as a family.
What do you think is the one thing that people misunderstand or need to understand about Woodstock?
I think how close it is. We're only 47 miles.
That's a good one, isn't it? That's sort of what I put it way out there.
Yeah, it's not as far as you think. It's a simple, easy day trip on the Metro line, and it's a terrific town worth visiting for just an afternoon or a day.
I know you guys have a lot of festivals, right? Any left this summer?
We do. Well, we have things coming up for the fall, so we have a continual farmers market, and we have activities in the fall as well, and then also an ale fest is one worth mentioning. We just got done with a number of them for the summer. RealWoodstock.com will have a continual update of all the things that we do out there.
Mike Turner from the City Council of Woodstock. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
It's the Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.